So the topic tonight, this afternoon, will be kind of the reason we've been teaching the four kinds of clear comprehension for the purpose of non-clinging or freedom. But to know non-clinging, we have to know clinging. So when I was in college, I worked my way through college as a massage therapist. And I had this one particular client. I was seeing him for the first time, and who had complained of lots of back pain and muscle aches. And so he was lying down on the massage table. And first thing I noticed was that both of his fists were clenched, and like really clenched. And his muscle in his back were tight. And I very gently, nicely reminded him to relax, you know, expecting to do so now that he was reminded and that he realized he was tense. But instead, to my surprise, he said, "I am relaxed." He had no idea that he was clenching his body. And when we cling, when we clench, there's an internal tension or pain that accompanies any clinging we have. It's dukkha. Though this inner tension doesn't feel good, we're often not aware of it. And for him, it was this very obvious thing that he wasn't aware of it. That most of us go through quite a bit of the day clinging to things and not even knowing we're doing it. And it's very hard to let go of clinging when we don't even know we're doing it. If we pick up a hot coal, we know it's painful and instinctively drop it. We set it down. But if we pick up an attitude of resentment, for instance, clinging to the thoughts and ideas that reinforce the resentment, they shouldn't have done that, it shouldn't be this way, we often don't even see the pain that it causes us, how we're harming ourselves. We don't even realize we have the option of letting go. And this path of mindfulness allows us to clearly see this clinging process. This is where clear comprehension really allows us to see these, the way we cling, the way we let go of clinging. We naturally drop it because it hurts. I saw a Peanuts cartoon, and Charlie Brown was talking with Linus. And Linus says, "I guess it's wrong always to be worrying about tomorrow. Maybe we should only think about today." And Charlie Brown, of course, said, "No, that's giving up. I'm still hoping that yesterday will get better." And most of our clinging is as useful to us as hoping that yesterday will get better. As the mind settles down in meditation, becomes more and more simple, it becomes easier to actually see this process of how we get caught and how clinging is released. Clinging is a little bit like a fish getting hooked by the bait. They reach for it and are caught by it. We see something attractive and quickly we're hooked. We want it. Or we experience something unpleasant and we're hooked. We got to get rid of it. In either way, once we get hooked, our sense of ease, or sense of presence is gone. It doesn't matter what we get hooked by. There's a real similarity to that feeling of tension, of contraction, and getting hooked in all its various shapes and forms. Humans are endlessly creative. We have figured out an infinite number of different ways to cling. We're fascinatingly creative this way. But the Buddha just pointed out four primary ways of clinging. I hesitate mentioning another Buddhist list, you know, but sometimes it's helpful because clinging can be so tricky. It hides from us. It hides itself. And just by kind of being alert to these different ways that we cling, it helps us get more familiar with the territory, much more likely to notice it. The first form of clinging is sensual clinging, which is the most obvious. It refers to wanting pleasurable physical experiences and avoiding unpleasant ones. Or maybe it's the pain we feel when our pleasure ends or we don't get what we want. I want it warmer, I want it softer, I want it to taste this way. I want it pretty, not ugly. I want the pain to go away. It can be an endless litany of trying to feel just right. I'll be able to practice when my back feels better, when my knee stops hurting. My guess is that most of us have had some experience with this form of clinging on this retreat. A little more insidious is the second type of clinging, is clinging to views. It can affect us deeply in all aspects of our lives. Views we hold about ourselves can in themselves cause us harm, such as believing that we're defective in some way, that we're unworthy, or we're not capable. When I was in middle school, I'm going back today, I used to tutor other children in math. And I was usually asked to tutor them when they were failing the class. And it was clear to me, even at that age, how their belief that they were incapable of understanding wouldn't even allow them to look at what was in front of them. And I realized that before I taught them anything, I had to somehow get them to consider the possibility that they could learn it. And they did. I mean, that's what's really beautiful, is that they did. When we hold views about other people, it can close our hearts. It can freeze the way we see someone, and we don't see them as a whole human being. When I was in college, there was a fellow student who was very accomplished in her young life. The problem was that she loved to remind us of that regularly. In my mind, that conceited part of her colored everything about her. She was a bragger, and I just did not like her. And I saw her as 95% braggart and 5% rest of human. And it was years later when I ran into her, and finally I got to see her as a whole human being with tons of other wonderful qualities and afflictive qualities, who just happened to be caught by clinging, just like me, just like most of us. In recent years in particular, it's become more obvious than ever how clinging to views about the world we live in has created such tremendous polarization in our world, and how widespread the suffering is from that clinging to views. clinging to views is often based in comparing mind. We believe we're better than others. And when we do that, we disconnect from them. Our love doesn't flow. It's all about me and mine. When we believe we're less than others, we're disconnected. Our hearts are contracted. We're withdrawn. When we're measuring and evaluating and comparing, we lose connection with what's real, with what's here. We're busy, all concerned in how we compare, and the connection is lost. Comparing minds sometimes, it's like saying, is the pink flower superior to the yellow one? Is the budding flower superior to the dying one? But clinging to views creates such a deep sense of separation and alienation in us. And the third type of clinging is clinging to rules and rituals. And the feeling at the time of the Buddha in the monastic community, that was a much, held a much more central place than it does in this modern culture. In my early spiritual practice, my husband and I practiced in a yoga-based spiritual community. And we called our practice, it was called Yoga of Awareness. And we would all gather together, and the teacher would begin the session by saying, place your palms together at the mind nerve at the center of your chest. And everybody would comply and then continue with the session. And both my husband and I started teaching there. But we began to have doubts about how aware that path was making us. And so one day when my husband was teaching the class, he wanted to make a point about it. And so instead he said, place your nerves together at the mind's edge. And no one noticed. And this is what we call empty ritual, a ritual without presence. Some of us are drawn to devotional practice, and it can be really beautiful. Even the simple things like a flower, a beautiful smell, a poem. There's different ways that people express this, a beautiful devotion. But devotion without presence is clinging to an empty ritual. In a different way that people who aren't devotional, how this applies to us is one of my major obstacles was that I felt like there was a right way to do the practice. And I was always trying to get it right. And I spent so much time struggling, trying to get it right and not trusting that I could just look and see. And that there's lots of room for awareness. Awareness wasn't this restrictive, narrow tunnel that you go through. That is a very wide open space with tons of possibility. Sometimes even thinking of the idea of the path of purification can create this duality of being pure or being impure, but not as a useful tool, but as something to contract around, to feel bad about, feel shame about. That we practice because we're purifying greed, hatred, and delusion, this human condition. The last form of clinging is clinging to the idea of self, self-identification, that there's a solid self. The Buddha didn't say there's a self or there's not a self, but that any self we think we find is temporary, disappears as we look at it, and that we can't find a single self. Any idea we have about it is not it. We seem to have the pervasive tendency to insert me or I in our experience and to contract around it, solidify it. I need to have this. I want it to be this way. I loved what Gil said yesterday, about spending the whole day without using the word I. I hope some of you try it. It's sort of fun to do. At least an hour. And not when you're in silence. But, you know, we're often my agitation, my peace, my meditation, my success, my failure, my pain. The self has a beautiful function. Maybe now we're the parent or the child or the teacher, the student. But these are roles that come and go. They come on and off like clothing as we need them. They're temporary and they're useful. We can come back again and again to the simplicity of our experience without chasing what we want, without holding on to views of how things should be, without trying to hold on to a universe that's constantly changing. There are also areas in our life that are latent or potential clinging. We're not hooked right now, but all it takes is a simple, reliable trigger. We sometimes refer to this as having energy on something or having a charge or something, a hair trigger. When I first came to this country as a child and I didn't speak English. I didn't dress the way everybody else dressed. And the way that sometimes kids can be cruel, they ridiculed my accent and the way I dressed, the way I looked. And years later, someone would correct something I mispronounced or tease me in a friendly way about it. And immediately, I'd have a whole series of bad feelings and just contract. Some people have energy on how they look, especially in this culture. Someone says, "You look tired," and it triggers a cascade of self-doubt. Or some people have energy on almost anything that comes from our parent. And it maybe triggers us to blow up over a minor, very minor comment. The potential to be hooked is always there. We are predisposed to this dormant clinging. What is it not to bite when we get baited? What is it to not get hooked when we get baited? Some years back, my husband and I had been having a conversation about attachment. And the next morning, I was making my morning coffee, happily enjoying it, just the way I like it. And I was holding it in my hand, in anticipation of drinking it. It was just perfect, you know. And my husband came up to me and started to take the coffee out of my hand, telling me, "You can't have any today." And instantly, I had a sudden intense contraction. I clung to my coffee and outrage arose. And of course, like my husband likes to do, he was teasing me, just pointing out something that I might not have seen. But what's it like not to get bait, not to get hooked, not to bite? When these things dangle in front of us, that juicy attachment. The Pali word for liberation, nibbana, means to go out like a fire and to cool. The word for clinging is upadana. And it's related. It means the fuel. It's what fuels the fire. It's the fuel that sustains the fire of greed, hatred, and delusion. Clinging is like the twigs and logs that we would feed the fire with. And we stop fueling the fire. It naturally goes out and suffering's extinguished. One way that I like viewing this is that the deeply ingrained habit of clinging is like a chain that binds us. But as we practice slowly, gradually, every moment of clear seeing, just a single moment, breath after breath, moment after moment of presence, begins to gradually thin the chain, weaken the chain. And when things get weakened enough, the chain can fall away. It finally breaks free. When when I was a teenager, I tie-dyed my sheets, these beautiful purple, blue clouds, but I used this inexpensive Rit dye. And the first several times I washed them, they looked the same. But a few months later, I noticed they were just a tiny bit less bright. And over time, they got more and more faded. And when I noticed, when I finally recycled my sheets, they were really very close to transparent, very faded. In the same way, we don't notice those, like, what's 1% of letting go? Would we notice that 1%? But that 1% builds. And it's really important not to underestimate just the power of one moment of showing up and not clinging. And as we do this, we begin to learn to trust this path of gradual awakening, of gradual purification, of gradual opening of the heart. And like the Buddha said, with dripping drops of water, the water jug is filled. We wouldn't notice that first drop, maybe not the second, but suddenly it's half full. And as you continue this path, or moments of non-clinging become more and more common, more and more pervasive. And sometimes we let go of something we've been planning, we've been clinging to completely. The lightness of sitting down, the burden is just delightful. At other times, we just lessen our grip on something. And that's rewarding also. One of the words, one of my favorite words used for liberation is the unconditioned, because it points to this universal conditioning of humans to grasp at what we want and push away what we don't want. And those two seemingly simple conditions are the source of much of the tremendous suffering of the world. And this is the core level of conditioning that's released when we don't cling. The world we experience through our senses is not the world our mind understands. The mind interprets the data from the senses, but uses our memories, or emotions, or biases to make sense of it, to fit it into the narrative of our lives. And it gives us the impression that this fabrication, this narrative, is solid and real. For example, our eyes literally see everything upside down. This is actually how the human eyes work. And then the brain just kicks in and turns it right side up. It's a little bizarre to think of that, that that's what's happening every moment when we're looking. And they did this science experiment where they gave somebody glasses to force them to see upside down. And it took about a week, but the mind, again, just flipped it right side up. And they were just able to see just normally with these glasses. And then they took them off finally, and it just took a day to go back to normal. There was a movie in the 80s. I don't know if some of you saw it, called The Gods Must Be Crazy. It pointed to how the mind creates our understanding of the world. There was a tribe of hunter-gatherers who were isolated from the rest of civilization when a passing pilot dropped an empty bottle in their midst. An empty Coke bottle. That was the point. Not having a context for it, they believed it was a gift from the gods. It fit their narrative. And this is what we do. This is what we do. We take in the data from our senses and we fit into our stories. And our senses are not the same as each other's. I love cilantro. I was quite surprised when one of my good friends told me it tastes like soap to them. It's genetic. Our senses are so different. My husband and I have had more than one conversation when I tried to convince him that my coat was brown and not gray. We have very different senses sometimes. That how we experience things coming in from the senses isn't just how we're wired. Most people who have their first cup of coffee don't like it. I don't know if anybody really liked it when they first tried it. Excuse me, I just got to notice my internet's unstable. But am I frozen? Can you hear me? You can still hear me. Okay. Okay. Just my visual is frozen. Okay. Let's see, where was I? So I was talking about coffee. I think I'm talking about that because I was a bit on the tired side. And so for the first time in years, I had a second cup of coffee today. So it's in my brain. But when I first had coffee, I thought it was pretty vile. But I noticed a couple hours later, wow, I was jazzed. It was great. And so very gradually, my emotional reaction to the coffee changed what I thought about it. And the smell of coffee is good. And so emotions affect how we perceive things. This process of fabricating the story of our lives creates a sense of self which seems solid and real. And our perceptions and attitudes seem solid and real, and they feel like they belong to us. And from that perspective, we try to find satisfaction in all the impermanent things of this world, which includes ourselves and everything we hold dear. And we don't find satisfaction there because it doesn't last. And when we do that, we may not realize that every atom in our body comes from somewhere else. Maybe from the Saharan desert, from Siberia, from stardust, from a child in Russia. We don't remember that the air we breathe in breath after breath, is the exhalation of the plants in this world. This practice brings us to deeply experience this reality of constant change. Everything is fluid. I exhaled. Those particles are no longer mine. They never were. Everything, but everything changes. There's nothing real to grab onto to make mine. And when nothing is mine to begin with, I don't have anything to lose, anything to protect. And there's nothing to cling to. There's no ephemeral thought that will keep me company. There's no passing emotion or mental state that will last. No passing body sensation or even body part that will last. It's all constantly changing. And as the Buddha said, one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So let's share a few minutes of silence.